freedom, if that was what it took. I sent a text message to Tox Barnes, the beginnings of an idea tingling in the back of my mind. "Something to try," I typed. "Maybe go round my apartment and turn the lights or TV on. If he broke into Sam's place, maybe he'll break into mine. Worth a shot." Tox didn't answer. He rarely did. But I knew he would know it was a good trap to set. Whoever this man was, he was obsessed with my brother. Now that Sam was off limits, maybe I could lure him over to me. Chapter 85. Cash had woken me from a thin sleep at sunrise by nudging the edge of my bed with his heavy boot. I'd heard him huffing around at 3 a.m., and it seemed he hadn't showered. He smelled of sweat. "It's all a setup," he said. "I'm going to need coffee if you're going to be vague," I said. A shimmer of hope went through me that he was talking about Sam's case. But he was holding a laptop, and when he sat down beside me, I saw it was full of Qantas ticketing information. "Jace Roberts' crew are making a run for it," Cash pointed to the screen. "An ASIO buddy sent me these after I put in for security checks on Robert and his three mates. In the last 6 months, all four of them have applied for passports. They've each booked a one-way ticket to Noora Rai Airport in Denpasar, all leaving on the same day."
"When?"
"Next week."
"They could be going on a Bucks weekend." I rubbed my eyes.
"John Steig." Cash brought up a mugshot of Jace's short, thick-bodied friend. "He's closed all his online gaming accounts and cashed in the remaining credit. Frank Scullin's divided his bank accounts with his wife in half and taken his share out in cash. Damien Ponch sold his truck."
"A big Bucks weekend?"
"One-way tickets, Blue." Cash nudged me. "Focus. I think this whole thing has been a misdirect, an exit strategy. They're not on the offensive. They're trying to hold us off, ensure we only react to the wrong circumstances."
"I don't understand."
"Get your things." He got up and kicked my bag towards me. "I'll explain on the way. Last chance might be in more danger than we thought." Chapter 86. Cash had the binoculars trained on Jace Roberts' house and was slowly adjusting the focus, the dial making a soft clicking as he rolled it with his fingers. The agent had plenty of high-tech equipment in his truck. Beyond the windshield, affixed to the hood of the car, a parabolic microphone was pointed towards the house on the plain. Now and then it picked up voices from inside, the clunking and shuffling of objects. Robert's three friends were inside with him, Frank Scullin, John Steig, and Damien Ponch. When the heat is on, criminals tend to band together, which isn't clever behaviour. Drug dealers call more frequent meetings. Bank robbers organise a late-night rendezvous. Young partygoers who got out of control one weekend and assaulted a girl all come together for a crisis talk to get their stories straight. Cash was muttering reconnaissance to himself like he couldn't help it, marking out distances and wind direction. "Four confirmed in the interior," he murmured, "none visible on the exterior."
"Yo, General Patton,"
I slapped his chest. "Tell me what's going on."
"Here's my theory. The gold we found at Chief Campbell's place belonged to these guys," Cash said.
"What makes you suspect that?"
"Think about it. Chief Campbell's got 80K worth of gold stashed in his house, and his wife doesn't know about it. It's not recorded as evidence at the police station. The very first people Olivia Campbell pointed to as suspects were these guys. She sensed they were a threat to her husband. She asked him what he was up to, and he said it was a drug sting. Well, we know that's not true. There's nothing in the police log about a sting operation. Snail knew nothing about it."
"Okay, I'm with you.
I think these guys acquired that gold from somewhere illegally," Cash said. "I think Theo Campbell found them with it, and he took it off their hands. We know from what Bella Destro said that Chief Campbell didn't always play by the rules. He might have stopped them on the road, or maybe they were acting weird and he was snooping around them for drugs, I don't know. But somehow, he discovered them with it and decided he'd just take it. Hmm? I nodded along. Now the guys have got a problem. They need to get rid of Theo Campbell, but there are 75 people in the town and they're no angels. They're likely to be the first suspects. How do they get rid of Campbell and control the circumstances around the investigation? Control the circumstances? I'm talking war tactics. He shook his head. I'm sorry. In hostile situations, you strategize to control how your enemy thinks and reacts. Bait them. Feed them false information. They constructed the diary, I said. Used it as bait to make sure we'd connect it with the bombing on the hill. They provided us with the answers before we'd asked any questions. We went looking for an angry teen. Exactly, he said. We've been totally distracted, looking for vengeful young spree killers in training, lone wolf terrorists. They put Zach Taibbi right under our noses. So why kill him? He was a great suspect. Maybe they weren't after Taibbi, he shrugged. Any of us could have got in that car. Maybe they weren't planning on any of us actually getting in. Zach got into the car at night. It was dark. In the daytime, someone would have looked in and seen those gas bottles in the back seat. It's possible they were just trying to scare us, make us evacuate the town. $80,000 is a lot of money, I said, but it's not much shared between four men. And if the whole goal was they get their rocks back, why didn't they take them? Maybe what we found at Campbell's house is just the tip of the iceberg, Cash said. Maybe there's so much gold they could all start new lives on it, and Theo Campbell was threatening to bring all their grand plans crashing down. I stared at the house before us, a little fibro shack in the middle of a hole in the middle of nowhere. I could imagine the temptation presented to people like these, scraping out a living from the hard earth. Zach Taibbi had wanted to run away. Did these men hear the same call of the horizon? Remember how the gold was packed, Cash said, wrapped in black plastic, bound with duct tape. Why wrap it like that? Because you want to store it, disguise it and ship it. I sat up and grabbed the criminal record sheets we'd printed out that morning for the crew inside the house. Jace Robert. Domestic assault, robbery, possession of a prohibited substance. Frank Scullin, assault, grievous bodily harm, theft. John Steig and Damien Ponch both had records for fraud. There were also domestic assaults, the complainants, their wives. Cash was right. These men were not the town's most upstanding citizens. They had every reason to want to get away from this life and the willingness to do it in an underhanded way. So what are they going to do? I said. They've already killed two people. They think we're well down the wrong track in the investigation. Are they just going to leave quietly? I don't know, Cash said. It worries me that they removed the massacre plan page. Maybe they just thought it was too much. But maybe they... He sighed, his voice uneven. Maybe they'll try to go out with a blast, he continued. A smoke screen. Slip away in the chaos. The microphone crackled. I sure as fuck hope so. Someone shouted. I hope he suffered big time, the little... I tell you what, this place would be better off with a quarter its inhabitants. 75 was far too many. 73 now, we're getting closer to perfect. The microphone crackled and went silent. I thumped the speaker sitting on the console between us. This thing is rubbish, I said. We need to get closer. I've already conducted a risk assessment, Cash said. This is our most effective reconnaissance base. We can do another assessment in 47 minutes if the wind changes, maybe.
I listened quietly to Cash's reasoning, then opened the car door and got out. Cash was behind me by the time I got to the edge of the property, crouching in the bracken. A handful of locusts, disturbed by my presence, fluttered up and around me. The sun was immediately blazing on my already burned face. I shielded myself against it and crept to the wire fence, to a collection of rusty steel drums.
"Don't get us killed, Harry," Cash murmured as he crept up behind me. "This is Jace's property. If he shoots us, he'll have three witnesses to tell the cops it was self-defense."
"What if I kill them?" I said. "What are you going to say?"
He rolled his eyes at me, shifted forwards, and signalled for me to wait. His combat tactics would get us up beside the house without being seen. I held on to the back of his belt, waited, sweating for him to move. He pointed forwards, and we rushed into the field towards the house.
Chapter 87. The grass was waist high. I huffed with exertion, just keeping up with my partner. Though my injuries from the explosion had been mild, it had taken a lot out of me. We flitted across the field and stopped short beneath the window. Cash checked under the house, and then flattened on the ground and started crawling underneath on his belly. It was hard to commando crawl with a broken arm. I dragged myself forwards with him, sweat sticking the dust to my cheeks. The floorboards creaked a meter above our heads. I twisted onto my side and lay in the dirt, watching my partner's face, his glasses fogging with condensation.
"It's not going to be a problem for much longer," someone said. "We get whatever the hell we can over the next couple of days and then we go."
"Your wife's going to be the one that'll give us trouble, Jono," someone else said. "Does she have any idea what we're doing?"
No, she doesn't have a clue. If any of yous touch her, mate, I'll fucking stab you."
"Do as he says," someone said. Sounded like Jace.
"Leave her alone. We don't want anyone drawing attention to us until we can get everything into place. After it's done, we'll be out of here."
Cash and I stared at the dirt between us, listening to the micro sounds as they came through the boards. Someone flipping the cap off a bottle of beer. The hiss of the compressed air escaping. Someone was standing right over us, causing dust to trickle down into our hair.
"I know this probably sounds weird," a voice said. "But do you ever, I don't know, have you ever thought about maybe staying once it's over?"
"Staying here? Mate, are you nuts? This place is a fucking shithole. We're talking about changing everything. Why the fuck would you want to stay?"
"Oh, I guess I feel like I kind of miss my kids, you know?"
There was silence. The men moved around, open and closed doors. There was a horse race playing on a television or radio somewhere. At least two of them fell to cheering the horses on. Groans of joy or sorrow, I couldn't tell, as the race ended.
"What time do you want to go out there tonight, then?" someone said.
Jace Roberts replied, "Usual time. Get out there at 8. Cash and I looked at each other. I saw movement out on the road and twisted slightly, squinted in the light.
"Oh, shit.
What?
Digger, the town dog, look."
Out on the road, the plump grey mutt was trotting along on its own, tongue waggling limply between its jaws. No clue where it was going, no sign of where it had come from. I knew that if there was one thing that dogs get excited about, other than food, it was humans lying on the ground. If the dog saw us, our risk assessment score would be through the roof. I squeezed my eyes shut. "Oh, God, don't let it look over here," I breathed. I heard the floorboards above me creak. "Don't move. Don't look at it. Maybe it won't see us."
As is typical with my luck, I chanced to look at the road just as Digger was glancing over into the shadows beneath the house. The dog stopped short, lifted her head, sniffed the air. I fancied I saw her smile as she began to bound towards us. Shit! Cash seethed. He sprang to his hands and knees, unsure of what to do. Fucking thing. The dog was running at us, barking with joy. I heard the men in the house above us shifting, moving to the front of the house, following the commotion. Chapter 88. Go, I told Cash. Get to cover. I'll distract it. Cash scampered to the back of the house, around the brick foundations, and disappeared between the long grass. Digger slammed into me, a flurry of licking and happy barks. What is that thing doing? I heard Jay sneer from above me. Fucking dog. I clamped my hands around the dog's muzzle. She gave a happy growl, tried to play-bite the cast on my arm. What's it got? Someone asked from the couch. A roo? Dunno. I'll go have a look. I crawled around the foundations, looking for somewhere to hide. If Jace Robert found me down here, he'd know I'd heard their plans to change everything, to abandon their kids and wives, a group of men fleeing after a dramatic act, whatever it might be. If he found me now... I gripped the bricks, tried to contain the rising panic. I looked up. There was a narrow gap between the brickwork and one of the wooden beams that crossed the bottom of the house. Just wide enough to snuggle into, just deep enough to hide in. I didn't know if I was strong enough to crawl up into it, to hold myself wedged in the space, but I had to try. I gathered a handful of the dry, powdery dirt from beneath me. Sorry, dog, I whispered. I flung the dirt in the dog's eyes. The animal yelped, twisted sideways. I put my feet into the gap beside the bricks and pulled myself upwards. Digger was blinded and ran out from beneath the house, trying to scrape at its eyes with its paws. Already my broken arm, braced against the wooden beam, was screaming with pain. I closed my eyes and held my stomach in, thought about stone, concrete, solid things. I was a part of the house. I was invisible. I heard Jace Robert walking down the porch stairs mere meters from me. Something was crawling along my side. Something big. I hoped it was a locust. At least a huntsman spider. Those big, hairy, but harmless creatures. I prayed silently that it wasn't a redback. Its needle-like legs were creeping slowly up my armpit, over the top of my shoulder. Well, what's wrong with you, stupid mongrel? Robert's feet appeared beside the dog. He crouched and I tucked my head up against the floorboards. My legs were starting to shake. I shifted my weight from one to the other, pushing hard against the walls of my little hidey hole with my arms. I could hear the man breathing, feel his gaze wandering over the dirt beneath me. Sweat was rolling down my ribs, collecting the front of my shirt. The crawling thing walked across my ear and over my temple. I squeezed my eyes shut as it wandered over the bridge of my nose. The urge to scream was all-consuming. Exhale. Scream. Relax. Fall. Give up, Harry. You can't do this. I heard Jace's leather boots creak as he stood. Get moving, idiot. He kicked the dog until it began to trot away. Jace sniffed and spat as he climbed the stairs back up to the house. I collapsed onto the ground with a thud and peeled the spider from my hair, flicking it away. An enormous redback. It rolled in the dust, oil-black legs wriggling, righted itself, and crept away. Chapter 89. Witt stood by the table at the very back of the police briefing room as the officers assembled in the chairs around him. Tox stood beside him, slowly devouring a mint-sliced biscuit, examining the treat closely between bites. It took all of Witt's resolve not to knock it out of his hand. His nerves were frazzled, and crumbs were falling all over the floor.
Wit needed control, perfection, now more than ever. He'd learned little more about Tox's deadly reputation, the murders he was supposed to have committed as a child. The man's records were sealed, and rumours of the event varied wildly. It seemed far more fashionable to simply join the masses and hate Tate, toxic Barnes, than it was to be certain of the facts. Wit was certain he didn't hate Tox, but he was far too nervous to like him either. "All right, listen up," Chief Morris said. The squat old man commanded the attention of the room. Young officers who had been laughing and chatting turned around in their seats. "We'll make this short so you can get back out on the road. We're getting a lot of calls from members of the public who have seen men fitting the EFIT description of McBeal's abductor. You're doing a good job attending to them. We're hoping to hone the search now with some new information we've just received." Tox seemed to get part of his biscuit stuck in his throat. He thumped his chest with his fist. Wit winced. "Forensics have done a sweep of the Pinkerton Hotel. Even though we've restricted the analysis to the underground basement where Caitlin was kept, there are still hundreds and hundreds of prints, and we can't tell which ones are relevant. It's taking time to narrow them down. We've been fast-tracking the prints through the national database, and some interesting characters have started turning up. We've shown their pictures to Caitlin, but she hasn't identified anyone. It's likely some of these guys might have changed their appearance since they were last in contact with police. Some of the photographs are very old." 6 images sprang onto the screen, all white men with the dazed, tired look of inmates appearing for mugshots, their mouths downturned and eyes distant. 3 were bearded. 1 wore thick-framed red glasses, smiling with missing front teeth. "Take a good look," Chief Morris said. "Some of these guys are off the grid. Long-term addicts, ex-cons. This one, Regan Banks, has a murder charge from 15 years ago. This one, Malcolm Donovan, does too. All the others have served time. Robberies, assaults, that sort of thing. But one of them might be our guy. You're going to split into teams and each track one of these guys down, bring them in for questioning." Chief Morris pushed a button on a nearby laptop, and another screen full of dead-eyed men appeared. Someone was walking through the tables, handing out printed copies of the faces. "We need to nab this guy before he does any more damage. This isn't over, people," Chief Morris said. "Not by a long shot." "I'm going to split off," Tox said through the remnants of a second biscuit. "Got to go check on Harry's place. You want to come?" "No, I'm going to stay here." Wit rubbed his face, pushed his fingers into his eye sockets and massaged the muscles there. It had been 24 solid hours since they found Caitlin McBeal, 36 or so since he'd slept. They'd been out most of the day driving around, following operational calls, running in and out of buildings looking for men with shaved heads. His temples were throbbing. "I'm going to put my head down in the coffee room so I can be here if they get a call." "Right." Tox gave Wit a slap on the arm and yanked his flak jacket off. He dropped it on the tabletop beside his partner. "I'll be back later." Wit watched his partner go, without knowing that he wouldn't be back at all. Chapter 90. It wasn't over for Regan. He stood by the windows of the discount electronics store and watched the pictures flashing on the huge flat screens, ran a hand over his shaven skull. 12 men the police wanted to speak to in relation to the abduction of Caitlin McBeal and possibly the Georges River killings. In the top right-hand corner of the screen, he saw his own face. Regan was sunken-cheeked and scruffy-haired in the picture, wearing the beard he'd grown in remand to try to make himself look fiercer than he really was, a wide-eyed teen being photographed for intake at Long Bay Correctional. He remembered the corrections officers taking the shot 15 years earlier. How terrified he'd been. He'd been able to hear the catcalls down the hall from where he stood,
the men waiting for him. It had been an apprenticeship in pain. Years learning how to take it, how to experience pain in so many unique and creative ways. When they'd come for him on his last days, Regan had looked at the man in the mirror on the wall of his cell, a master of suffering. As he left the cell block that had been his home, Regan had felt his muscles tightening, hardening. He'd walked through the administration block to collect his belongings and felt his fingers lengthen to talons. Through the transition cages, he'd felt black wings unfurling from his shoulder blades. In the car park where they left him, free to go wherever he pleased, his eyes had begun to burn with bloody, furious tears. Regan realized that all along, he'd been designed to evolve into the thing he was now, this monster. His time in prison had been a natural steeling process, an incubation period. A thing as hard as him needed to be forged. All goodness needed to be squeezed from it. Empathy, passion, weakness. Standing there in the parking lot in the dark, the distant sounds of the waves crashing against the cliffs beyond the prison, he closed his eyes and remembered Sam Blue. All the time he'd been locked away, Regan hadn't dared call his friend's face to his mind. He'd been afraid of the fury that would come, the bloody memories. He remembered Sam and knew only that he needed to find him. Regan stood looking at his own face on the television screen now. Inevitably, the news story shifted and there he was. Beautiful Sam, with his downcast eyes and hollow cheeks. Regan put a hand on the window and bent low, focused on the tiny pixels that made up the man's face. Sam, his soulmate. Chapter 91. Cash and I drove back down the main street after our surveillance on the Robert property. There were patrol officers in the town, borrowed from towns all around, talking to people at their fences. Mick the bartender was leaving his house with an armful of towels, watching us roll by, his big belly making a single circle of sweat on his t-shirt where the flesh dipped inwards at his navel. I pulled Cash's arm, gesturing for him to stop. From the street outside the little house across from Victoria Snail's property, I could hear children playing inside. As I went to the door, the young mother I'd seen the night Zach Taby lost his life shouted from somewhere towards the rear of the building. I knocked, and two young ones, maybe 3 and 4 years old, ran to the screen door and stared expectantly up at me. I'd seen these golden-haired children that night in their pyjamas. The mother was tired when she came to the door, uncomposed, expecting someone else. She remembered me. "I'm Harriet Blue," I said. "This is my partner, Elliot Cash." She opened the door. The kids tumbled out, seemingly very impressed with Cash, a thickly muscled superhero towering above them. There was no sign of a dad here. "Mary Skinner," the mother said, smiling. "You too, get back in here." The kids giggled and ran into the cool, dark hall. I followed Mary past a wall of framed photographs, backpacks hanging on hooks, a wooden rack inadequately small for the dozens of dusty shoes piled onto it. We went to the kitchen, and she didn't offer us coffee. She was uncomfortable, picking at fingernails split from nibbling. "You probably know why I'm here," I said. "The bombings." She glanced towards the door as something crashed in one of the bedrooms. "It's terrifying. Have you got a suspect yet?" "We've got some leads," I said, "but I think maybe you could lengthen them for me. I don't know if you remember what you said to me 2 nights ago when I was out there on your porch." Mary had tucked one arm into her ribs the other tight against her chest. She opened the fridge to give herself somewhere to look. "I don't remember anything much except the blast," she said. "I was watching out the window when it happened. I saw you fall. Are you okay? I mean..." She examined my broken arm. "Nothing permanent." "I'm fine," I said. "You told me that it was all going to come out. You said it's all coming to an end." Mary looked horrified. Cash was sitting on a stool by the kitchen bench quite near her, measuring the response on her face. She took a bottle of water from the fridge and set it on the counter, turned away from us both. "I didn't say that," she said quietly. "Yes, you did. Look, I'm alone here." She threw me a hard look, on the edge of snapping. "I lost a child. I lost a husband. I say weird things sometimes that I don't necessarily mean." The silence that fell was heavy. I could hear the children whispering beyond the door. I looked at them, and they squealed and ran away. "What happened?" I asked. "My husband left. He's up north, Cairns." "I mean to your child," I said. "You said you..." "Brandon overdosed." Mary's gaze was locked on me. "It was an accident. He and his friends had been messing around with stuff brought in by the truckers. He was 17, child of my first marriage." "I'm sorry," I said. "I don't have anything else for you." Mary shut the fridge door hard, made jars rattle inside it. "That's it. Now I've got things to do here." She let us walk ourselves out. The sun seemed somehow closer, more foreboding. I felt I'd disturbed something. Shifted a rock off an insect I didn't recognize, something dangerous. Something better left alone. Chapter 92. All his life, Regan had enjoyed ruining beautiful things. It was a strange sort of instinct, an impulse, the same kind of impulse that drove people to fix pictures hanging crookedly on walls or scrub single greasy fingerprints off otherwise blessedly clean window panes. When new toys came into the youth care facility playroom, he'd break them. Shiny and glossy and smelling of plastic, with their bubbly eyes and stupidly grinning mouths, they seemed painfully perfect. He'd pull out a teddy's eye, snap off a robot's arm, cut a doll's hair so that it stuck out of the bulbous rubber scalp in ugly tufts. The broken, dirtied things gave him joy. Maybe he felt they were more like him when they were torn and crooked. He was only small. He couldn't know. Then he turned his attention to the other boys and girls. It had begun with pretty little Claudia, with her big eyes and golden curls. Claudia would be adopted in a snap. The carers were already talking about it. She was a doll, they said. Regan had snuck into the kitchen and found a packet of matches. She wasn't so perfect when he was done with her. Regan became difficult. The word was mentioned around him in a lot of different ways, between foster families and care workers. He listened to them chattering above him like he wasn't there. There had been difficulties at his last home. He was difficult to place because of his difficult behaviour. There were other words. Oppositional, aggressive, introverted. Regan was 16 when he met Sam. He'd been standing by the cake table at one of those pathetic Christmas events the Department of Children's Services ran every year at the town hall. Sam had been a lanky, pale kid, his limp black hair constantly hanging in his eyes. He was the only other teen at the stupid party. Regan had watched him for a long while, bored, until he saw Sam observing the gorgeous Christmas cake someone had baked for the occasion. Perfect edges, immaculate red and green icing, Sam had reached out when no one was looking and pushed one of the lollies on the top of the cake until it sank into the soft, spongy interior, leaving a gaping hole in the design. Regan had smiled. Sam had seen it. Regan had found him. His perfect match. But as always, it wasn't long before that perfection was ruined. Soon there would be blood and screaming. The adult Regan remembered now as he walked down the empty, dark street, his head low, the baseball cap pulled down over his eyes. Everything was so messy now. So dark, so torn. A beautiful and terrifying time. The very street seemed awash with new life. Regan came around a corner and a group of young women swirled and ebbed around him. Perfume. He felt the muscles of his shoulders knot, the bones grinding in his neck. Marissa. Elle. Rosetta. His girls. His sacrifices to Sam. The women on the street passed him, a glittering flock of birds. There wasn't time for that now. That part of his life was over. Regan glanced now and then at the paper in his hand, the numbers on the buildings around him. He reached the pale blue building and looked up to the third floor windows facing the distant water. The lights in Harriet Blue's apartment were on. Chapter 93. People think that in the Australian desert there's nowhere to hide, that it makes the perfect hunting ground because for hundreds of kilometres there is no cover. Barren sand oceans dotted here and there with clumps of thin, dead or dying trees. In truth, the desert is full of holes. From where I stood with Cash, Last Chance Valley was almost invisible in the distance, but for a small rise where the rocky rim poked through the horizon. I knew that beyond where we stood, there would be cracks and crevices in the desert, some kilometres deep, reaching far enough down into the earth for a person to disappear into. It's a treacherous place, a place not to be wandered into on moonless nights. It does make the perfect hunting ground, but not for its barrenness. It's porous, full of secrets. It was here in the depths of the desert that we met the forensics team. We'd spent the day on the ridge, watching Jace Roberts' property. Two men from the team who had dealt with the burned car at Snail's house drove up to our spot in the desert now in a dusty four-wheel drive. The moustached one who had looked at me so strangely in Snail's hallway. "I'm Glenn, this is Wayne." He shook Cash's hand, ignored me. "We just finished up with the vehicle, it's all here." He handed Cash a report. "I might need you guys to stick around in the town, just be an extra hand if we need it. Something's happening tonight at 8, Cash explained to them. "We've got some interesting suspects moving about. Harry and I will be on this group, and we'll get Snail and some other officers on the town." Glenn gave me another nasty look. I jutted my chin at him, a challenge. "What's your problem, mate?" "Nothing," he said, shrugging. "Come on, out with it." He sighed, gave his offsider a look. "I know who you are. I was there at your brother's apartment when they went in after the arrest." There was a meaningful silence among the men around me. I felt a weight steadily increasing on my shoulders. "Yeah?" I said. "What's your point?" "My point is that I saw the evidence, Detective Blue. The duct tape on the bed, the messy sheets, the video camera. It was sick. I have nightmares about what happened in that apartment. I find it mildly infuriating that you've stuck by your brother all this time, that's all." "Nothing happened in that apartment," I said. "Maybe we should just..." Cash said. "What's your explanation then?" Glenn said. I've heard you say your brother is being framed. You must believe he was framed by this guy the police are hunting right now. The shaven-headed guy, the one who abducted Caitlin McBeal. The guy who told her he was Sam's partner. So what, this guy abducts these girls right from under your brother's nose and savagely murders them and dumps them like pieces of trash? He waits until Sam goes to work and he says, ha ha, now's my chance to do it again. He abducts Caitlin and he's all ready to do his nasty business on her when, oh, hot damn, Sam's been arrested. Shit, holy moly, this wasn't in the script. Mate, Cash stepped forwards, put a hand out, just back down. So the guy thinks, shit, I'd better hightail it over to Sam's place and plant that evidence I was going to plant before the police raid the place. Glenn was waving his hands theatrically now. He waited for me to give him some kind of answer, but no words would come. Isn't it more likely, Glenn said, that Sam was going to go home that night and this man with the shaved head was going to be there and they were going to kill Caitlin McBeal together? You're violent, detective. Everybody knows that. Isn't it more likely that your brother is violent too than the gentle, misunderstood, innocent man you say he is? Let's be real. There was an old and familiar Harry who would have stepped forwards and uppercut the man before me. A swift and hard skyward thrust. But when I called on her, I found her too tired to wake. I turned and walked towards the car, heard Cash calling after me as I got in. This time, I didn't have the strength to fight, to face my troubles. I ran. Chapter 94. Let's be real. I drove through the desert, being real. Yes, my brother had confessed the murders of three beautiful young women who studied at the same university he worked at 3 days a week. They'd disappeared, as Glenn the forensics asshole had said, from right under my brother's nose. It was likely these things had happened because my brother had killed them. Yes, an awful collection of violent sexual pornography was found in my brother's apartment. It was likely this was because Sam himself had acquired that material. Because he liked it, because he'd used it to fuel his fantasies, because he was a killer. Yes, it was likely that whoever the man with the shaved head was, he'd told Caitlin McBeal that he was my brother's partner because he was indeed my brother's partner. Yes, it was likely that Sam was violent because I was violent, that he had a dark edge, a beast inside that he could not control, a vicious internal guard dog, identical to the one that had started growing inside me almost from the moment I was born. It was a hellhound, a ferocious thing that I unleashed whenever I needed to. I'd let him free as a child when foster fathers and older brothers crept into my bedroom at night, when kids at new schools ragged on me. When the men I hunted in my job got away with what they'd done to their victims, and someone had to pick up the slack. My dog was dangerous. It leapt out before I could stop it. Sometimes I could wrangle it back, but the beast had done such a good job over the years protecting me. It was too strong and wild now for me to ever hope to tame. Did Sam have a beast inside? Had it gone feral on him? Got a taste for blood it couldn't sate? No, I would never believe that, could never ever believe that, because if it could happen to him, it could happen to me. Chapter 95. Again, I came upon Jed Chatt's house without meaning to, and I pulled into the driveway with horror, realizing I'd probably been under the gaze of his rifle for the last kilometer without thinking about it. The crosshairs trained on my face. I wiped at my cheeks and found tears. This wasn't good. I got out and walked up the rocky slope, still arguing with Glenn in my mind. Digger the dog burst into a sprint from where she had emerged at the side of the porch, barking happily at me. Oh, you, I wiped my nose. The dog jumped and pawed at my waist, and I rubbed her furry head. I'm sorry about before. Jed Chatt came out the front door of the house and stood watching me, a general look of disapproval on his face.
"I told you to rack off," he said.
"Yeah," I said, leading the dog towards him. "People do that." He rolled his eyes, weary, and strode back into the house, letting the screen door slap shut. I noticed how remarkably the house had changed. The porch had been swept bare and the old barbecue was gone. The dog followed me inside. The lanky, long-jawed man was sitting on the faded couch now with an assortment of plastic parts in front of him, tiny screws and brightly coloured joints. A baby's play gym, half-assembled, some of it still in the shipping box beside him. There must have been so much of this activity in the time since I had seen him last. Gathering up, sorting, squaring away his own things, making room for the new life that had joined him. Beside the couch on the floor, the infant reclined in a fluffy, pale blue bouncer. Now and then, Jed extended his leg and pushed on the bouncer with his big bare toe, causing the baby to bob gently up and down. The man seemed mildly irritated by my presence, but not curious. I might have stood there an hour without either of us uttering a word. I didn't fully understand the ease I felt around this man. But I knew then that unconsciously I'd been planning to flee here the moment Glenn started attacking me. What was it about this man and this place that compelled me? "You're a strange one, you," Jed said after a time. "I get the feeling you might be the same." I looked at the infant in the bouncer, an awkward, gummy smile playing about perfect lips he couldn't yet control. "Can I?" I asked. Jed said nothing. I extracted the child carefully from his bouncer. He was heavier and warmer than I'd imagined. The baby swiped at my chin, my lips. I kissed his fingers.
"His mother is my niece," Jed said eventually, glancing at the child's chubby hand encircling my finger. "I don't know her that well, or I didn't. Her parents died some years back, and I never was real good at keeping in touch. She wrote me a couple of months ago, couldn't call me. I don't have a phone."
Jed left the construction of the mobile and sat back on the couch, rested a bare foot on his knee. "She grew up over Bandalong way, even harsher than this Bandalong. So when she got to the city, she was real surprised, and so was everybody else, to tell you the truth. She did her degree, did the extra bits and pieces that come afterwards, whatever they are. And then, to top it all off, she got accepted into this extra special legal program. Always wanted to be a lawyer in this program. She says there is something like 3 people in the whole country who get in. Well, she got in. First black fella in the history of the world to get in. Kind of thing that usually goes to white boys from private schools on the Sydney Harbour there. The other 2 candidates were just that. They were pretty upset that they were up against her for the position that you get at the end of it, the partnership or whatever." The child had gone to sleep in my arms. Wisps of his soft black hair, finer than cotton, shifted in the breeze from the window. "Same morning my niece was due to go in and sign her big important contract, she finds out about this one." He nodded at the baby in my arms. "Everybody has a good laugh at her then. The 2 other candidates, they reckon they're shoo-ins for the partnership at the end of the 4-year program. One of the big lawyer types running the thing, he wants her chucked out of the program straight away unless she gets an abortion. So she writes me asking what she should do. I'm about the last bit of family she's got, and she doesn't know me from a bar of soap, but she needs to talk to someone."
"What did you say?" I asked. "I told her to do the program, and I told her to have the baby. I'd take him until she was through with it, until she found her feet, and if she never found her feet, well, that was okay. I figured if she'd dropped out, she'd have been all broken up about it.
If she'd had an abortion, she'd have been broken up about that too. This was the only way I could think of that she could get out of it without tearing herself in half. The infant grizzled. I lifted him higher against my chest and patted his nappy-covered backside, put my cheek on his head. "It's not the best place in the world," Jed said, looking at the walls, still stained from years of neglect, the blazing desert sun rolling by the windows. "But it's a solution to a problem." Jed stood. I guessed it was the signal for me to go. I didn't seem capable at first of giving the child back. Some ludicrous part of me saw this place as a solution to my problem, to every problem. I handed back the child. He held the tiny boy and looked at my eyes. Seemed to know I wanted to stay. Here was a safe place, deliberately constructed on the edge of nowhere, too far into the wild for problems to reach. The kind of place they sang about in sad songs. All the hurt, all the badness, all the worry a person had could be sent here to be swallowed up by this man. I felt the cruel sense that I belonged here tugging at my chest, even as I headed for the door. Chapter 96. It had all happened so quickly. Love stories were like that, so Regan had heard. He'd got chatting to the teenage Sam Blue at the Christmas party and discovered the gangly, shy, black-haired boy was living with a family in Panania, not far from where Regan was in Picnic Point. Their foster parents knew each other. Sam had only just arrived, having been separated from his sister after their last placement fell through. The boy missed her. Regan had listened, marvelling quietly at his gentle voice. There was no way Regan could have told Sam what he felt back then. The obsessive thoughts, the dreams about Sam. He wondered if his friend ever suspected. It was a struggle to stop himself from bringing Sam gifts at the house in Panania, turning up too often, staying too late to talk and giggle in the small blue room his foster parents had put him in. Everything Sam said stuck with Regan. He'd shown Regan a picture of a red racer bike in a catalogue, and Regan had begun to see red bikes everywhere, deliciously displayed on street corners and in bike racks, unlocked. Regan closed his eyes sometimes and thought about what Sam would say if he brought in one of those racers. Imagined him in awe, crying with gratitude, throwing his arms around Regan, the press of his thin, hard body against his own. Bliss. But it was far too risky. Their bond was one perfect thing he wasn't going to ruin. It was pure, untouchable, beautiful. Joyous months passed. Sam and Regan would meet on the roadway down to the river, firelight and smoke in the air, the heady scent of dope near the rock wall or on the grey sand, circles of other kids laughing, whooping. Regan remembered sitting on the edge of the pier with his feet in the water and some nameless girl's face in his crotch smoothing back her hair as she bobbed up and down on him, looking over and meeting Sam's eye as another girl worked on him. A stab of pleasure deep in his guts, making his legs twitch. They'd lain with the girls afterwards, whoever they were. The girls were easy to ignore. Regan closed his eyes and felt Sam's elbow touching his. Listened to the other boys breathing. It could have been just the two of them under the stars. He suddenly felt free. And then, before he knew it, Child Services was there at the door in Picnic Point. His foster parents had decided to travel to Italy and couldn't bring him along. Another placement had been arranged. The couple told Child Services to handle telling Regan because they were too emotional about it, and they knew he was an emotional boy too. They'd meant difficult, but they couldn't possibly know that Regan was slowly graduating from difficult to dangerous. Chapter 97. Now, Regan stepped silently down onto the toilet in Harriet Blue's apartment and turned around, sliding the bathroom window closed behind him. The gentle click as the latch caught was the only sound in the apartment. He stood in the dark, looking at the things on her vanity, feeling sick little zings of excitement at the sight of them. Comb, pill packets, creams. He went into the short hallway and gazed at the gold light falling on the polished floorboards from the living room. This was a good apartment. A solid investment for someone who worked hard and spent little on their social life. Regan knew that the place had been sold, probably to fund Sam's legal defense. In mere weeks, all of this would have to be packed up and shipped out. Regan was glad that he could see it as it was, Harry in her natural environment, the girl Sam had talked so much about. There was no one home, he was sure of it. The lights must have been a tactic by Harriet to appear at home, something to drive away the press or curious gawkers who might try to take advantage and sneak in. Regan had the distinct sense of her abandonment of the place as he walked into the study. He looked at the work of the Georges River Killer on the corkboard behind the desk. Pictures of his victims, both alive and as he'd left them, lolling dead on the grey sands like washed-up sea creatures. There were forensic reports here, criminal profiles, Harry's notes. Regan had seen some of these things already in the briefcase he stole from Edward Whittaker. They were close behind him. But it wasn't over yet. If only it had all gone the way he'd planned, it would have been so perfect. He'd come across Sam for the first time after leaving prison, and it was there that he'd got his idea. Sam had been standing at the edge of the hall outside a computer lab on the Sydney Uni campus, talking to one of his pretty little students, her long chocolate hair awash in sunlight. Regan had followed and watched and realized that Sam was surrounded by these gorgeous creatures. They waved at him from cafe tables and touched his arm as he went by, smiling, asking about some assignment or another. Sam was so happy. Regan could see it in his stride as he walked home, as he climbed the stairs to his neat, bright apartment. Wasn't Sam just the perfect fuck you to all those care workers and all those families shuffling him here and there? The raggedy, hollow-eyed urchin Regan knew so well playing tricks in the dark by the riverside. Bad boy. Difficult boy. Unwanted boy. Sam's beautiful world was choreographed as joyously as the opening of a Broadway show. People swinging on lampposts, arms out, soaring voices. Regan had entered Sam's world like a dark cloud creeping, billowing up over the horizon. He'd wanted to stay longer. It had all been going too well. He moved out of the study, back into the hall, and heard a sound in the kitchen. Chapter 98. I picked up cash. He'd stayed by our surveillance spot, lying on his belly at the edge of the ridge, watching the sun go down, sweeping the valley with his binoculars. He didn't speak as he got into the car. There was an icy feeling in the pit of my stomach that he'd call me out for walking off instead of standing my ground and defending my brother. But my ability to stand my ground was waning. Two more days and the Avo would be lifted, and I could be by Sam's side again. "We've got a problem," Cash said, breaking me out of my reverie. "What?" "Des spread the word around town that people aren't to congregate, that we want the pub closed and the main street clear. This seems to have had the opposite effect. People are angry, defiant. There's talk they're going to gather tonight in the main street as a show of strength." "Ah, brilliant," I snapped. "What a fantastic idea. We've told them it's dangerous to gather in groups, and what do? They decide to throw a party. They're Australians, Cash said. We told them to stay away from their local pub. We might as well have waved a red flag in front of a bull. There were already people on the main street as we drove through, standing outside shops, talking. Only 12 or 13 in total, but more would come. There was a strange excitement in the air, the feel of Christmas or New Year's Eve, of community. It didn't seem to